Free Your Mind with Papa Wabe Thursday mornings from 2 to 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time here on WPFW 89.3 FM, your jazz and justice station, making it a better world, one broadcast at
a time.
Yo,
peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we're listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
This is a journey. Journey to the sound.
Would you join me, please, in welcoming me?
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing.
I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
With the finger roll, plus the foul.
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day, or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Collision. This is the place where we talk about sports and politics at your home for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM WPFW, trying to change this blight of a world and country one broadcast at a time. I'm Dave Zirin, joined as always by somebody who I think needs no introduction, but if you've read his books or if you remember his play on the court, you know he's a special soul with a perspective that's utterly fearless, which frankly we need more of in this society. I'm of course talking about Etan Thomas. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good, Dave. How you doing?
Man, we have so much to discuss, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, just to let everybody know, and everybody knows that sometimes when I do the run of the show, we don't get to everything, but we're really going to try today. We're going to talk about the, I think, very shocking first round loss of the Los Angeles Lakers. Every single ESPN pundit who does basketball for a living had them losing to the Minnesota Timberwolves in the first round. I think we also have to talk about Shedeur Sanders and his historic drop in the NFL draft. This wasn't dropping one round or 20 spots. A first-round pick, someone who thought was going to be picked third overall in the draft, going in the fifth round. We need to talk about Saquon Barkley and his trip to the White House and some of the things he said to Donald Trump, which have a lot of people angry at Saquon to the point of which he felt like he had to respond. And then I really do hope we have time for this, Etan. As you know, I visited Mumia Abu-Jamal in prison last week for 4 hours, and I'd love to read the 500-word intro that I wrote about the experience, intro to an article that will be written eventually. How does that sound, sir?
That sounds great. Let's do it.
All right, first and foremost, I am dedicating this show, myself, Etan, and if you have a dedication, feel free, but to a WPFW listener named Mertice, who is at my table at the 48th anniversary of WPFW, an incredible event. Shout out to Mayuki Williams. Shout out to Katia Stitt. It was remarkable, a night of music, food, dance, and fellowship. And Etan, I drove straight there from the state prison in Frackville, Pennsylvania, where I was interviewing Mumia. And wow. Let me tell you something, man. It was food for the soul because, as I know you know this well from your work, you spend 4 hours in a prison. You see people, you know, like families getting together, little kids hugging their dads, wives, girlfriends, parents. I mean, it's pretty heavy to see human beings living in captivity like that. So especially someone like Mumia, who is an innocent person of just tremendous brilliance. So it was a hell of an experience, man. And the WPFW event, it really did lift me back up when I was feeling pretty low.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. That's special. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that. But first and foremost, the Los Angeles Lakers. Shock in a shock to the pundits, although I'm not sure it really should be a shock if we really look at this closely, lose in just 5 games to the Minnesota Timberwolves in the first round of the NBA playoffs. They lose 103-96. Rudy Gobert, the center for the T-Wolves, who had barely showed up in this series, had playoff career highs with 27 points. And Etan, hold on to your history of being a center hat, 24 rebounds. Julius Randle had 23 points. And about how the Lakers did, better said, less. LeBron has never had a playoff exit like this in 5 games in the first round. Luka Doncic, their other star, frankly, I thought was kind of embarrassing throughout this series. We can talk about that. And their coach, first-year coach J.J. Redick, was thoroughly outcoached by T-Wolves coach Chris Finch in a way that made you feel like you were watching Big Brother play Little Brother in a game of basketball. So, Etan, I bring it to you. How did Minnesota win this game? How did the Lakers lose? How do we understand this?
Well, where do you want to start? You know, I thought it was interesting that J.J. Redick elected to go small. Mm-hmm. And stay small throughout the entire game. So I understand it if you try it as a strategy, you know, something you want to try to see if you can do and, you know, spread them out. And they know, of course, Rudy Gobert can't guard a pick and roll. He can't guard on the perimeter and everything like that. And, you know, he doesn't shoot threes and he's a little bit of a, you know, a liability on the offensive end. I get all that. But when you do it and you see it's not working, why do you stay with it the entire mm-hmm. game? And so they had Rudy Gobert looking like a young Wilt Chamberlain out there. Like he was just dominating. Like he was dominating so much, even Shaq had to give him props and say that he was dominating.
Never thought I'd see the day.
Yes. So, I mean, and it was just really lobs and, you know, put back dunks and, you know, drive and throw it up to Rudy. And he just kept dunking and getting rebounds. And they didn't ever make the adjustment. And so there's a young player, Jackson Hayes, who has been playing well. He's just been playing limited minutes. So I have no idea why, you know, Reggie Miller said that JJ told him before the game that he was not going to play Jackson Hayes and he was going to go small. So that was his game plan from the beginning. Okay, I get that. But when it doesn't work, how do you not make any adjustments? That's my question to you. How do you keep letting one person beat you the way that they did?
Yeah, and a player whose greatest offensive ability is just height and his ability to get rebounds. And that's why Rudy Gobert gets so clowned on the offensive end and is so disrespected because he can't really do that much. And yet he can do something if you're guarding him with Rui Hachimura, all respect to Rui, former Wizard. But Rui is 6'8". Yeah. And Rudy Gobert is just a mountain of a person, an absolute disaster for anybody who's going to try to guard him at 6'8" down low. I mean, here's the thing that was so ridiculous about J.J. Redick's coaching last night. In the second half, he actually did concede for a few minutes of, wow, I need to have someone in there who's 6'10", 7 feet, who can actually body up against Rudy Gobert. Does he bring in young Jackson Hayes to do it? No. He brings in Max Kleber Max Kleber. Max Kleber, who's getting over a broke, I mean, no disrespect because he's been a good player, but he's been on the Lakers for only a couple of minutes longer than I've been on the Lakers.
Right.
And he had just broke his foot. I mean, at least I wouldn't have had a broken foot. And Kleber was entirely ineffective. He was quickly pulled out of the game. So does Redick then adjust and say, well, I guess I should bring in Jackson Hayes just to switch it up a little bit? He does not. And what's so thoroughly embarrassing about J.J. Redick's coaching in this game is that the T-Wolves went historically cold from three-point range in this game.
They did.
Do you want to know the numbers on this?
What's the numbers?
You're going to, like, want to never play basketball again when you hear this. You're going to want to, like, swear off this version of the NBA. They went 7-47.
Oh, wow. I know it was that bad.
7-47. I'm looking at this right now. 7-47. And so you have to take advantage of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, my goodness, they're cold from three. All they can really do is rebound and do putbacks. So you don't put somebody in who can box out Rudy Gobert, who has barely shown up in the first four games of this playoff series?
Yeah, that's all bad. But horrible coaching. Yeah, it was horrible coaching. But on the flip side, we got to give props to Anthony Edwards. Like, I mean, he talks big game, a huge game. He talks so much, and he talks from the beginning to the end. Like, you know, he did the little Spider-Man thing at the game one, and everybody was like, whoa, it's a little early to be doing that now. But he kept going. He's going to keep talking while he's playing, you know, before he's playing and after he's playing. But I do like that he does pay homage to the, you know, his elders. He does give, you know, LeBron props, just like he gave KD props last year. And you know, he does that. But yeah, he is fearless, and his level of confidence kind of extends to the whole rest of the team. You know what I mean? Like, he gives them extra confidence because he's so confident. If that makes
sense. I have a great question for you right now. Going after everything you saw in this series, imagine Etan Thomas is owning an NBA team and has a magic wand, okay?
Okay.
Do you want 26-year-old Luka Doncic for the next 5 years on your team, or do you want 23-year-old Anthony Edwards for the next 5 years on your team?
Oh, I'm taking Edwards all day.
You answered that quick.
Oh, no. Well, for one thing, though, is Anthony Edwards plays defense. Luka does not play defense. As great as he is offensively, he plays zero defense. I mean, and it's you could like look at some of the clips of just, he's like
a
liability. Like they're just completely blowing by him. Like he's not even moving his feet one step to like almost get there. He's like not even close. It's just like like they're working out against cones, like doing the cone drills, and they're just blowing by him. You know, so that's. But let me ask you this: did you see the footage of Anthony Edwards circling the arena afterwards and talking noise to all the fans and saying, "Yeah, y'all said Lakers in five." Did you see that footage?
No.
Oh my gosh, he makes me laugh. So it's so funny when I watch him, because he is so confident and he's so young and so brash and so loud mouth and everything like that. And I gotta ask you this. Do you think that Muhammad Ali would have been a big fan of Anthony Edwards? And this is why I ask, because I remember when the Fab Five was like at their heyday and Muhammad Ali came to the, I think there was either in the Final Four or something like that. Remember that footage of Juwan Howard doing the Cabbage Patch? I don't know if you know what the Cabbage Patch is, but he was all hyped afterwards. And
I'm out.
He was saying, "Rumble, young man, rumble." Because that's that, and the reason why he did that is because they had just met Muhammad Ali. And he was like, "I'm a big fan of yours, and I love what you all are doing." And that gave them all this juice. And so every time that I see Anthony Edwards do that, I think, man, you know what I'm saying? Muhammad Ali would have loved that. So watching him go around the arena talking, smiling, you know what I mean? Rubbing everybody's nose in it, telling everybody about themselves, telling like I told you I was going to do it. None of y'all believed me. I think back, I was like, yeah, Muhammad Ali would have been a big fan of his.
All right, first of all, Etan, how can you possibly, after all the time we've known each other, ask me if I know what the Cabbage Patch is?
Oh, I'm sorry. Out of everything I said, that's what stuck out to you.
That's all. I frankly, everything else you said was just like a big noise in my ears, like the wind blowing.
My bad. No disrespect.
No, I'm just playing. Yes. You know what's interesting is I think of Muhammad Ali. Here's an interesting category because we're not talking about politics right now. We're talking about
politics.
Except in a weird way we are, because we're talking about black confidence in this country, in a white supremacist society. And frankly, this relates pretty directly to the Shedeur Sanders conversation, which we can have. So as we transition to that conversation, I will say to you that I think Muhammad Ali, Charles Barkley, and Anthony Edwards, what they all have in common is they will talk that talk, they will smack that smack, but they do it in a way with the slightest smile that makes you want to be on their side, that makes you want to be part of their action, that makes them feel like, okay, that makes you feel like, okay, I feel more confident in their presence, you know? And that is to me like contrasted with a player, and I'm just gonna say it because I've got my beef, Draymond Green, who talks that smack, but can also be aggressively unlikable. Like you can't, like maybe he's not everyone's cup of tea, but I love me some Anthony Edwards. You know what I'm saying? like feed it into my veins. Give me more. Like as soon as the show's over, I'm going to be looking up him talking smack to the Lakers fans. Like I'm all about it. And I think that's a very, particularly again, in a white supremacist society, to be able to have the skill to navigate that with confidence, but also be able to make people want to like be magnetic, you know what I'm saying? At the same time, it's a very, very particular skill, and goodness gracious, does Anthony Edwards have it? And goodness gracious, does frankly, Luka Doncic not have it?
But also on the flip side, it is also a huge turnoff, as we saw with Shedeur Sanders, to the other side of the coin, to mainstream America, to MAGA America, who see that black confidence and see it as a threat. See it, and then you start hearing words as like uppity, or like they need to be humbled, or things of that nature. And you've heard that certain language just kind of seep in there when they speak about Anthony Edwards and Shedeur Sanders and Angel Reese and, you know, the Fab Five. It's that black confidence that becomes threatening. Like, how dare you be that confident?
And that's, let's just take it right to Shedeur Sanders, the quarterback prospect out of Colorado, the son of Deion Sanders, thought to be, could be picked as high as number three in the entire draft by the New York Giants. Maybe even some people were talking about number two to the Browns. But then other people were like, no, he's going to fall to 21 to the Steelers, or, you know, and then some people were like, well, he might even fall to the second round, and people just because of team's quarterback needs. And other people said, fall to the second round, that would be the most hellacious drop in history, you know, of a top prospect. That's even worse than Aaron Rodgers. What are you talking about? And he lasted to the fifth round, picked by the Browns. He wasn't even the first quarterback taken by the Browns. And the thing about it, Etan, that I find wild is you used two phrases that are so interesting to me, two words. One is uppity, and the other is needs to be humbled. And what I found so interesting is the word uppity has very direct, very explicit racial connotations. It goes back over a century, you know, God knows, two centuries in this country of calling black people who dare assert themselves uppity. You heard that more in my experience, Etan, in this, and please say otherwise if you haven't. To me, I saw that word more on social media, message boards, you know, people who could say those kinds of words anonymously. Mm-hmm. I was shocked at the number of big time ESPN podcasts, like people who are the biggest names in football media using that phrase humbled and his mm-hmm. need to be humbled. And it'll be good for him that he got humbled. And I just keep thinking to myself, like, there are so many white quarterbacks
who are far from humble.
And that's always presented as a plus. He's got edge. He's an alpha male. He leads the locker room. You know, he's got that confidence. Not Shadur. He's not granted that.
You know what? Let's take a quick little break and come back, because there's a lot that we could delve into with this. But let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more on The Collision, where sports and politics collide.
Something new for this fight. I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.
Come on! To the boot, more bass than Bootsy Collins. You versus me, that's like Ali versus Foreman. God's act, stand back and watch. Devil's timeout, can't be timed with no swatch. Watch who I am, the Black Abraham. Zungo, Zungo, Zang, Yellow Man, Vietnam. Adding extra bars, I spar with little chore. Taking kingdoms from czars, winning more wars than the moors.
Now what's the deal, star? I seen the devil spar with the law. Mathematics was the key to set my whole race free. You might debate me, a refugee, no harm hurt me. Dying thirsty from the struggle till my own hustle bubble on the low. What was me to show the free bar, right? The righteous Asiatic, take a while, Shaitan rob light. Civilized like the Molly Burgundy. Wally rockin', seen the fifth when Ali clocked him. John Forte, you keep you locked in.
Yeah, that was beyond perfect. This is The Collision, or as we say, The Collision. I'm Dave Zirin. I'm here along with Etan Thomas, WPFW, trying to change this world one broadcast at a time. Etan, I know you selected that because it went with the conversation. What did we just listen to?
That was the Fugees, and we didn't even get to all the, like, later on in the song, you got Lauryn Hill coming on, you got Q-Tip, you got Fife Dawg comes on. You got Busta Rhymes at the end. Yeah, it's a classic song from when we were
kids. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've met Fife Dawg twice in my life. Rest in peace. I met him. This is just such a crazy thing to me, Etan. I met him when I was 17 and we hung out. And I met him when I was 37 and we hung out.
Wow.
And when I met him at 37, I told him about the time we met when we were 17. I was 17. And he was like so nice, and he was like, "Yo, we got to do an interview, man. We got to talk." That's and then he passed away.
Yeah.
A lesson I've always taken with me is never take for granted the wonderful people you meet in this life.
Definitely,
because you just don't know. But let's take it to you. Speaking of don't know, no one knew Shadur Sanders was going to drop to that fifth round. I got a point I want to make connecting it to Ali, who we just heard. But by all means, go right ahead. Please, you first.
Well, no. I'm just going along with what you're saying, because that you asked about the term humbled, and you kept hearing that from different reporters who consistently were saying that. You saw it all on social media, and they were mm-hmm. almost like cheering that he didn't get picked in the first round. Like cheering, like, okay, now maybe that'll, you know, humble him. Maybe now he will. And I was like, wow, like, yo. Really, and it's that whole threat of that Black confidence that you talked about. And right now, and I did a meme, and I compared it to, you know, that same hatred that you heard from with Angel Reese confidence, and you just saw people then spewing hate at Angel Reese. Then I said that you know, with the Fab Five, and they spewing hate the Fab Five. Oh, that's why they never won. I was like, so y'all are still mad? You were making my point. You know what I mean? I was like, y'all are making my point. Why are you so mad right now? Because they're confident? And it's that level of confidence that has all of the people just really, you know, in mainstream America, really just rooting against Shadur. And it's amazing to see. Yeah, it's amazing to see.
Yeah, it is something, especially as we said, like the quarterback double standard. Of the qualities that they say they look for in a quarterback. And humility is frankly rarely one of them. And yet they wanted Shadur to be humbled. Two things I'll say about this. You know, one of the great misnomers of sports history, one of the great lies, let me just say that, of sports history, and this goes to what we just heard on the track, is that people started, the media, I mean, white America, they started to hate Muhammad Ali when he joined the Nation of Islam. Mm-hmm. And then they hated him even more when he stood up to the war in Vietnam and refused the draft. This is simply not true. Not that they hated him. That is dead true. But the hatred started mm-hmm. at the Olympics in 1960 when he was 18. Because he was so brash. Because he was so bold. Because he liked to talk. Because he wasn't like previous generations of black fighters who really rested their fame on their humility because of the lesson of Jack Johnson at the turn of the century. Muhammad Ali was like the revenge of Jack Johnson at the beginning part of his career. Like saying, I'm going to use this platform to be as unapologetically black as I want to be. And I am the greatest. I am the best in the world. I am so pretty. No one had heard that. No one had heard that. And it was mind-boggling for so much of the press. Even the black press did not want to hear him saying that. And that's what I saw in Shadur Sanders, because Shadur Sanders obviously does not have Muhammad Ali's politics. Donald Trump put out a tweet praising Shadur and asking, why isn't he being drafted? I'm great friends with Dion, great friends. Mm-hmm. And frankly, that statement might have made people want to draft Shadur even less hearing that. Even though all the owners support Trump, they don't like him, you know, being loud about their business. We've seen that happen before. They're like, we'll give you millions. Just leave our league alone, please. So this is, I think, a part of it, too, is that gives the game away, is that level of confidence. And you see this common thread. You mentioned the Fab Five of confidence alone from a black athlete becoming politicized. It's not politicized from a white quarterback, even if people think that quarterback is too cocky. As a white quarterback is too cocky, it's never politicized the way it was for Shadur. And this is never, ever, I think, going to be forgotten. It's going to be remembered either as the great motivator that made Shadur Sanders a Hall of Fame quarterback, mm-hmm. or it's going to be remembered like a ghost story, like them telling young black athletes, do not mess around, you know, bow and scrape, basically, or you will suffer the fate of Shadur Sanders. One of those two things, or maybe frankly, both those things are going to happen in the aftermath of this.
You know, you mentioned the way that other quarterbacks were treated. Does anybody remember the name of Johnny Manziel? The way that he conducted himself, the way that he was brash, and the way that he was cocky, and everything that they said that Shadur was. And that didn't stop him from being in the first round.
And you remember who picked him, right?
The NFL draft. That was Cleveland.
That was Cleveland, yeah.
It was Cleveland, yeah, 100%.
And Cleveland passed on Shadur four times this time, and finally just took him because it was like, wow, like, how do we not at that point? I mean, I wonder if he would have been drafted at all if Cleveland hadn't stepped in there, and what an outrage that would have been. I mean, the other thing I really don't get in this, well, I do get it, but one of the other things you heard, and believe me, I've heard this from a lot of insiders who know people on the inside, is they found Shadur Sanders in the interviews to be ungrateful for the opportunities, and them identifying his lack of gratitude to him growing up rich. Yeah, I don't know if you heard that one too, but like him growing up with money made him unappealing to NFL teams. Now, people might not know this, but Johnny Manziel grew up very wealthy.
Very wealthy.
Very wealthy. Obviously, the Manning family growing up, very wealthy.
Right.
that was never used against them.
Not at all. But you, and also to add to that, you know, they talked about their hatred for Deion Sanders, his father, and the fact that he had the audacity to even think that he can tell a team that he doesn't think that they're the best place for his son. Mm-hmm. And the level of like, how dare you? And how, and I had to go back to the draft. I believe it was in 2004, the 2004 NFL draft with Eli Manning. If you remember, he was going to be the number one pick. He was the number one pick. And he made it known, him and his father, Archie Manning, that they did not want to go to the Chargers.
Mm-hmm.
They said it publicly. We do not want to go to the Chargers. And it's almost like to where we refuse, if they draft us, we're not going to go there. Like, we're going to sit out the entire season. Like, that level.
Right.
And yes, there were a lot of people, like, even at the draft, you saw the people booing when the Chargers did pick him. And you saw the backlash, right? But it wasn't the same as Deion's backlash of how do you have the audacity to even think that you can do that, and you are outside of your place. You know what I mean? Like, it was a different level of hatred. And that's the part where you get back to the uppity thing that you said earlier. It's that uppity that no matter how, what level you are, as a black man in this country, you could be Barack Obama level, you know what I mean, of being the president of the United States and still be accused of being uppity.
Don't wear that tan suit.
There's a certain level of thankfulness and humbleness that you're always supposed to exhibit to white America if you are a black man, no matter what position you're in. And if you don't exhibit that, then you're going to hear the words like ungrateful and privileged and, you know, all those different things, because it's not expected from white people. It's just expected from black men in particular.
And so interesting as well, that if there was one thing that everybody respected about Shedeur Sanders, the haters as well, is everybody had to give him the fact that Colorado had no running game and the worst. One person said the worst offensive line in all of college football. And yet, for all the hits Shedeur took, for all the lack of running that he had around him, he always popped right up and was there for the next play and performed like the biggest bad bleep in the world when clutch time was on. And so that doesn't jibe with their whole, oh, he's so privileged, you know, which usually means, let's be honest, a little bit soft. You know, that's so, it's like it even didn't work at the level of criticism, other than saying we don't trust wealthy black people because they won't be grateful enough to us for the money we are giving them.
Right.
That's how it came across.
What?
But yeah. I digress. Let's go to break right now because it is the bottom of the hour. When we come back, we got to talk a little Saquon and Mumia. I want to get to everything this week. So I want to talk about Saquon Barkley with you because you had strong things to say about his trip to the White House with the Eagles and how he conducted himself. But I digress. Let's go to break right now. We'll be back right after this on The Collision, where sports and politics collide. Shout out to everybody who was at the WPFW 48th. Shout out to Mertice again. We'll be back right after this.
Yo. Round one up in the Mecca, yes, we back in the garden with no resistance. When we leaving, every piston departed. The Knicks are the hardest. We coming, fam, see how we played. And Cunningham are taking L because his team is decayed. Yeah, you used to be the baddest, but currently you nothing. When it come to talking Jalen, what's a Durin to a Brunson? What's a harder way to heart? Okay, we hearing no discussion. Could be Harris, could be Beasley. OG clearing with the buckets, gotta love it. We locking down Stewart and Schroeder, we do this. Don't you know what we about to do to your shooters? We about to throw down in Motown. Can't control towns, he's profound. We got the gold crown, you winning no rounds. Knicks about to set the record straight in case you wasn't listening. They scared that we gon' take over their stadium in Michigan. Came in here with bridges, deuced up in the game with Michigan. You saying you the bad boys, we came to teach them discipline.
Goodness, that was fierce. We're back here on The Collision. Magic Mike on the Wheels of Steel. He's Etan Thomas, a person whose name speaks for itself. I'm Dave Zirin. Etan, what did we just listen to? That was great.
That was a cat named Danny James, a.k.a. Little D. And yeah, that was his Knicks freestyle. He's a big Knicks fan, so he has like a few freestyles out there, but that was one specific for this Detroit series.
Love that. Wow, Detroit. Wow, is he? He's not from Detroit though, is he, Lil D?
No, he's from New York. Yeah, he's from New York.
Gotcha, he's from New York. Just had to ask because one, Lil D, I wondered if it was connected to the D Detroit, and I hear freestyle in Detroit. I'm thinking like, take on Eminem.
Yeah, nah, he's all New York, all New York.
I love that every time Anthony Mackie is in some big budget movie, like he's the new Captain America, there are all these little computer memes like the one person Captain America fears, and it's a shot of Little Rabbit from 8 Mile.
It keeps
Captain America's
up.
Kryptonite.
That's hilarious.
I can't help crack up, partly because Mackie's so baby-faced in that movie. But yeah. It doesn't look like he looks now. But I digress. Taking it to Saquon Barkley, the Eagles, or actually I should just say some of the Eagles, visiting Trump's White House. What do you have to tell us about that, Etan?
I mean, I posted a meme and I quoted you in it, and you was quoting what Occupy Democrats actually posted, and they were showing what had just happened. So basically, it said Trump's ICE thugs just invaded an innocent American family's homes, forced a woman and her three daughters onto the lawn half naked, seized their phone, laptops, their life savings, and then just left them like an abandoned dog. And it was a terrible scene. But this is what's becoming normal. They had 20 armed federal agents, and they raided the wrong house. That's what it was. And the family had no connection to the suspects. They were U.S. citizens. They, had just moved to wherever they were. And their belongings were actually taken as evidence, even with all of that. And it's just that level of stripping of Americans' rights just to be able to say that this the thought that you are in here illegally. And even if you are in here illegally, there's still due process. There's a way that you're in. There was a interview that a journalist did, and the name escapes me right now, and I hate when that happens. I can't think of the name. But he was sitting there with Trump, and he was interviewing him, and he was basically telling him all of the things that he's doing right now that's illegal. And Trump was pushing back on everything, but he just didn't back down. It is a great interview. I got it. Terry Moran from ABC.
Terry Moran at ABC. Here we go.
Terry Moran from ABC News. Please go and look that interview up. If you have a chance after this, look up Terry Moran, and he's sitting down with Trump. And that tells you, with Trump's answers, what he plans and what he wants to implement. So going back to what your quote was that every athlete that, and I'm paraphrasing here, but you said every athlete that visits the White House, they're normalizing this. Mm-hmm. They're like okaying this. They're cheering on this, and they need to be told about it. So when Saquon goes there and he says that I'm just here because I'm, what do you say? I'm honoring the position or,
the office.
And it's like, yeah, it's a lot deeper than that. No, just the position of the office can still be in the wrong. That whole respect for the position of the office. I really hate that response, but that's why we have to give so much props to the amount of Eagles who didn't go to the White House. And, it means something. It means that you are showing the world and telling the world, this is not something that I am in approval of, and I'm not going to support this. And it's, mm. it's
it's really important. Like, and I'm glad that you're bringing this, you know, to light, and you stay on them with that. As far as there should be chastisement, because if that's why when Shaq went over and hugged Trump at that UFC fight, that means something. That image of him, it's not just respect for the position. You, when you are doing that, you are saying that you are in agreement with what they're doing. Like, you know, like you're giving a thumbs up. Like, yes, like you, it's more than just a handshake. It's more than just a gesture of visiting the White House. It's a statement. And when an athlete chooses to, and yes, the athlete has the freedom to be able to choose whatever statement that they want to choose, but you can't deny that you are making a statement, and it definitely means something.
Yeah, and I'm glad in what you set up on Instagram, and people should check it out. You started with the story. One thing you didn't mention is that happened in Oklahoma, your old stomping grounds, which I'm sure hit close to home in its way, because you know how things operate in Oklahoma.
Definitely.
There's a reason you don't live there, for example. But it's really something to me that an athlete can just say, well, I respect the office, so I'm going to go there. I'll never forget when I interviewed Greg Popovich, and he said to me, it's not about respecting the office. It's about whether the person holding the office earns respect through their actions. And Saquon also, it's not just this sort of a respect for the office. He was bragging about playing golf with Trump, you know, just a great old guy, all this stuff. And this is happening with unprecedented attacks on people, particularly brown people in this country, Arabs, Muslims, Latinos. And let's not forget the full frontal attacks on Black history, like removing books from shelves, you know, all the rumors that are coming out about all the stuff they're going to remove from the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And to go a place where, by the way, sports teams have a long tradition of visiting when they come to Washington, D.C. That's a thing that regularly happens there when they're maybe not in hockey, but the other sports when they come here. That's right. A tour stop. Greg Popovich would do that every year with the Spurs, but he's far from alone. And so to just pretend like this is just a dude doing his thing, like, look, I very much respect the argument that a lot of previous presidents have paved the road for Trump, from Clinton's Crime Bill and Anti-Terrorism Act, Bush's Patriot Act, Obama with the drone attacks that even killed U.S. citizens. All of these things are like breadcrumbs that Trump then took and said, okay, attacking citizens, ending due process, ending privacy through technology. This is the collection of breadcrumbs that led us to this moment. But what Trump is doing, he's taken all those breadcrumbs and he's made himself a massive loaf of bread that he's forcing down all of our throats and choking us on. And it's next level. And when you're, and Jalen Hurts clearly sees that, the quarterback, and he's a conscious person, as he's made clear. And another person who I've got much respect for is a player on the Eagles who didn't show up, who just retired, named Brandon Graham. Now, why am I mentioning Brandon Graham? I'm mentioning Brandon Graham because the whole Kaepernick period that you and I have spent so much time discussing was 9 years ago. That's a lifetime in the NFL.
It was 9 years ago?
2016 season.
Goodness.
8.5 years, which is, it's actually two life cycles plus of NFL players, because the average career lasts 3.5 years.
Right.
Brandon Graham is the only player on that team with the, who was part of that back then, who didn't go to the White House when the Eagles won it all in 2018. And so to see some, who was a good friend of Michael Bennett. And so to see him carry that institutional memory forward, like, wait a minute, there was a reason not even Tom Brady visited this White House during Trump's first term. Don't you remember when he called NFL players SOBs? called us out on our names. Don't we remember when he said that players should get fired for kneeling? Are we forgetting all of this now and pretending like this guy's our best friend and we roll out the red carpet at the Super Bowl? You know, so this is deeply, deeply problematic for me when people show and not just pretend it's like business as usual, because I was just as critical of the Dodgers for showing up there when just days before there was the whole controversy of them erasing Jackie Robinson and his military record from the Department of Defense website and the way that organization just cloaks itself in the memory of Jackie Robinson. So, you know, there are real, not just issues with it, but there are social costs that regular people have to pay when you normalize this White House.
I agree. Definitely agree.
Dang. It's really something. So shall we please talk about Mumia Abu-Jamal?
Yes, please. That sounds absolutely amazing. Please go ahead. You have the floor for the rest of the time that we have.
Oh, good gracious. No. I got to know if you have any questions or follow-ups.
Just take it from the top. I mean, you just go. Like, I can't even – that's absolutely amazing. I want to hear all the details you can squeeze in.
I am going to read – may I read something? Is that okay?
Yes, definitely.
And then hit me with it. All right, I'm going to read fast so we get some time here. All right. On West Center Street in Mahonoy, Pennsylvania – sits Molly Maguire Historical Park. It's not a tribute to a kindly woman named Molly. It is a monument and history chiseled into marble about the Molly Maguires, a secret late 19th century organization of Irish labor militants. It's a reminder to never forget that 20 Molly Maguires were hanged to death between 1877 and 1879. As the U.S. government website for now reads, this park is a reminder for the freedoms that were fought to make things better for future generations and to stop the oppression in society. 7 minutes away from this park is the Mahonoy State Correctional Institution in Frackville, Pennsylvania. And if you want to see a symbol of oppression in society, that's just a stroll away. Behind the walls and bars, in a situation he describes as live from slow motion death row, is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a former Black Panther and award-winning culture reporter for NPR. He was a well-known radical media and political prodigy in Philadelphia with a bright future. That's what made his jailing for the killing of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner 44 years ago over a traffic stop so difficult to believe. Jamal has always maintained his innocence. He says they needed someone to arrest, and he was targeted for his politics and skin color by a criminal justice establishment that has since built their careers on his case. The powerful Fraternal Order of Police also committed themselves to his conviction, and the judge in his case, Albert Sabo, was an FOP member. The much written about trial was a bleep show, and Jamal's constitutional rights, according to Amnesty International, were a casualty of misconduct. So who better to speak about the current criminal justice nightmare in the United States from the perspective of his jail cell? Mumia and I will discuss due process, the Constitution, and sending prisoners to El Salvadoran labor camps for indefinite detention without a trial. A self-described history nerd, Jamal is a C-SPAN junkie, quote unquote, who has written or edited 15 books. We also talk about past dissidents like the Molly Maguires and how a new generation of political prisoners now hides in plain sight in Louisiana detention centers and in the overcrowded torture cells of El Salvador. You know, at the bottom of the Parks Department description of the Molly Maguire Historical Park, it reads, there will be different ways to interpret the story in the future, but this is a reminder of a better way of life that we now enjoy. Not everyone enjoys a better way of life. Not everybody's 7 minutes away. Someday, Mumia Abu-Jamal's state narrative will change, and a better way of life in this country should be judged upon whether the U.S. prison industrial complex, now spanning from Maine to Latin America, has been abolished. It should also be judged on whether Jamal ever gets to live after 44 years outside of a cell. So that's what I wrote to kick it off, Etan. Mumia and I sat for 4 hours. We talked about all the things I just said and how it all relates, frankly, to his case. He's incredibly well-read. His knowledge of history, economics, how they all play into everything that we're seeing right now was profound. I learned so much from the man, and I'm forever grateful to both him and his lawyer, Noel Hanrahan, for getting me inside Frackville State Prison, not an easy thing, and having the chance to talk to him.
Goodness gracious, that had to be absolutely overwhelming.
It was difficult more than anything, because I know you've done prison work. Maybe a lot of our audience does not quite understand what I'm about to say. Mm-hmm. It was a 5-minute walk to get from the parking lot to the area in kind of a cafeteria looking place where prisoners would come out and see their families. And Mumia and I were able to sit at a table for all those hours. It's so disturbing to me that the difference between breathing free air for me and going back to a cell for him is 5 minutes.
Wow.
It's amazing that we couldn't, to me, it was just gobsmacking that we couldn't have this talk and then just me just say to him, hey, you need a ride to the airport. And him saying, sure. And us just walking outside in 5 minutes. And all the concrete and guns and human beings who stood in the way of the 71-year-old man who I believe was wrongly convicted and who at minimum had every single right that we take for granted and which I guess now no longer exist, completely violated in his trial. And it just affected me deeply. I mean, a mind like that behind bars, someone with that much love in his heart behind bars, it was painful. And I hope I can bring light to his case, because one thing that he said was that since he's become a lifer instead of someone on death row, that urgency people don't feel in the same way. But meanwhile, he's now in what he just calls slow motion death row.
Wow. Slow motion death row.
Mm-hmm.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah. I mean, when you're a lifer, it's still death row. It's just, and the difference is you don't know the date.
And just know that that's your reality of what you have to wake up to. That every single day, that you don't know the date, but like you said, you're a lifer, and it could literally be any day that they decide, you know, today's the day.
Mm-hmm. Or the day where the poor food and poor health care that you experience as a senior citizen, which is what he is, catches up with you. Because it's not a good situation. There are health issues. I mean, I can't speak to them. But there are, I'm forbidden to, but there are health issues that just simply are not being addressed that are very upsetting. Because, you know, what's the most upsetting part is talking to his lawyer. Like, sure, some of it is just to make his life more difficult because he's Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mm-hmm. But it's also because she said the primary reason he can't get the health care he needs is because it's a privatized prison that works through like 3 different healthcare private contracts, subcontractors. And so just getting healthcare for any prisoner is a nightmare. An absolute, because of our privatized healthcare system. So that was also just very upsetting as well. But a great man. And I can't wait to show everybody the interview when it comes out. I just absolutely, it's going to take a few weeks. And I can't say anything more about it because we're keeping it very hush-hush as far as publication and the like. Not my typical place where I publish. That's all I'm going to say. Right. But that's all I got. Etan Thomas, any last words? We've hit the end of the show.
No. It was a great show as always. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, this one was something else, man. I mean, this went by at the speed of a Shedeur Sanders throw.
I see what you did there.
It did not go with the speed of Luka Doncic running up and down a court.
Or playing defense.
Oh, Lord. Or getting his shot blocked by Naz Reid two times on three-pointers, which never happens. His release looks so slow, but I digress.
Yeah.
Props to everybody out there. Peace to the New York Knicks. Shout out to Mertis. For Etan Thomas, I'm Dave Zirin. We are out of here. Peace. Stay connected to the lifeline.
Slip up, you trip up your Wi-Fi. When we click up, we lift up the crime. WTFW commemorates the birthday of James Joseph Brown on May 3rd from 7 a.m. to midnight. Revolution of the Mind, unpacking the genius and torment of James Brown. We'll feature his music, delve into his complicated and tumultuous family history and sometimes troubling behavior, and celebrate his artistic, entrepreneurial, and activist legacy, including James's live performances in Ghana, Zambia, and Zaire, present-day DRC. That's Revolution of the Mind, unpacking the genius and torment of James Brown, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 a.m. to midnight on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time. Full schedule found on WPFWFM.org.
My Body, My Festival 2025, DC's only abortion access music festival, is coming May 16th and 17th. Presented by the DC Abortion Fund and Burger Sounds, My Body, My Festival will take place at the Black Cat and Union Stage, featuring local artists across genres, including Alex Vaughn, Carly Harvey, Cicely, Taisha Estrada, B. Steadwell, Zoe Jorgensen, and more. My Body, My Festival is a celebration of our city and ensuring abortion care is available to all who need it. Details at mybodymyfestival.com.
WPFW has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture for 48 years. Our spring membership drive begins with a special celebration of James Brown's birthday, May 3rd, and closes with a centennial birthday celebration of Malcolm X on May 19th. Two pillars of music and message. Your financial sustenance is needed more than ever to continue this type of programming. As a new listener or current member, this is your opportunity to contribute to the growth of an institution that stands resolute against both gross injustice and repression and the mass erasure of history and culture by amplifying the voices of scholars, artists, and activists whose work centers the humanity of all people. That's 48 years of being a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture, May 3rd through the 19th. WPFW works daily to build the world we want to inhabit by building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
I'm Dennis Williams with the WPFW editorial. Kilmar Abrego Garcia, an apprentice sheet metal worker raising three children with his wife in Prince George's County, has been kidnapped by the United States government. On March 12th, Abrego Garcia was pulled over by ICE agents accused of being a member of the Salvadoran gang MS-13 and then transported to a terrorist confinement center in his native El Salvador. In fact, Abrego Garcia had fled his homeland at 16 because of threats from local gangs, and a U.S. immigration judge in 2019 granted him protection from being deported because he would face persecution if he ever returned. The Justice Department admitted that his removal was an administrative error, and the U.S. Supreme Court ordered the government to facilitate the return of Abrego Garcia, who has never been charged with a crime or found to have any gang affiliation. President Trump shrugged and said that it was up to El Salvador. Salvadoran dictator Nayib Bukele, appearing in the Oval Office, scoffed that the idea of releasing him was, quote, preposterous, while Trump and top advisors smiled approvingly. This is an appalling violation of law and of justice that must not be allowed to stand.